I'm excited to start the book of Judges. First and foremost, because it's not Daniel. And Daniel, I don't know about y'all, Daniel got to where it was wearing on me near the end of our discussion. It was a great study. Don't regret in the least going through it, but it did start to a little bit wear on me at the end. So change in this particular instance is a good thing. So I'm excited to be able to start the book of Judges. I hope that you are too. I love the Old Testament. You find things in the Old Testament that you just don't find anywhere else in the New Testament. And I think sometimes because the New Testament talks about Jesus and it lays out the plan of salvation and God's terms of salvation, we do have a tendency perhaps to give ourselves more so to a study of New Testament books. And we can't overstudy the books of the New Testament, the plan of salvation, and those things that we find therein. However, oftentimes the Old Testament, especially books like the book of Judges, is oftentimes cast to the side simply because of the nature of the book. But you learn a lot about God when you delve into books of the Old Testament. I was brought up on Old Testament stories, and so I have a special love. The Old Testament has a special place in my heart, and I am just happy to be able to teach from it the upcoming study. Let me say on the outset, I want to change a little bit of the dynamic of the class. I don't want this to be, as the book of Daniel had a tendency to be in its latter chapters, a sit and listen kind of class. I very much want to encourage audience participation. That means questions are welcome by anyone. Comments are welcome by anyone. As always, we won't necessarily promise answers, but we can give consideration to the questions. And at some point in time, get an answer that may or may not be acceptable to you. But I want to kind of open it up to have everyone more involved, those who would be willing to participate by answering questions, by asking questions, by sharing their thoughts, by adding their own personal application. Kind of want to change the dynamic of that. The latter portion of the book of Daniel just simply really did not lend itself to that kind of class. But I believe that you'll find, as you read through the book of Judges, there are things that we could all really add or contribute to the class. So I'm going to very much encourage that. Probably next Sunday, maybe by this upcoming Wednesday, I'll have some binders to hand out. If you notice, I put holes in the questions. And if you don't have a copy of the questions for chapter 1, you can grab those from the back after our class. But got holes in those because I've got some binders I'm going to want to hand out. After each chapter, we'll probably have more questions. Along the way, we may have some maps and other things that will help in our study as a whole. So we'll have those hopefully ready on this upcoming Wednesday. I apologize I don't have them already, but I'll try to have those ready. The idea kind of came to me after the fact, a little bit too late. But we'll try to have those ready at least at the very latest by next Sunday, so you'll be able to grab and keep all of your questions and maps and things like that in a single place to help you stay organized and best benefit from the class. Let me also encourage you, as you grab those questions, I know you probably realize from the get-go, and you probably realize when Zach typed these questions up, that they're not going to be fill in the blank, and they're not going to be true and false. I'm sorry, but I'm the teacher that everybody hates in school. They're discussion questions. The purpose, since we're changing the way the class goes a little bit to encourage participation from the audience, they are more discussion-based. What you'll find is there may not be a 100% right answer. Somebody may be able to answer it one way, and someone else may be able to answer it another, and guess what? We can both be right, or we can both be wrong, or we can both be unsure. But the point of the questions are to stimulate discussion, to really get you thinking, and as we read through this book and as we study it, to not just be able to relay the story and tell of the facts, but more so to delve into the book itself and to see how this book can affect my life and how it encourages me as I strive to live some 3,000 or 4,000 years past the stories that we read here. So application's going to be something that we're going to focus on. If you've got your questions, let me just briefly point out, you're going to see question 1, 2, and question 8 as reoccurring in each and every chapter. And I'm kind of excited about question 1, where I'm encouraging you, as you read through this chapter, undoubtedly there are going to be things that you just don't understand. And so write down at the beginning of your study something that you just don't know the answer to. And if it is an answer in the course of our study, then please bring that out after we conclude the chapter so that we might be able to answer the question that you wrote down. Because there's just a lot of strange stuff going on here in the book. A lot of things that we don't always take the time to consider. Question 2 is always going to be there because there usually is a passage that is key in the chapter itself. And that's going to be reoccurring because as we go from chapter to chapter each time, that's going to change. And each time it'll be different. And what stands out to you may not stand out to somebody else. So hopefully that'll help foster some discussion in our group as well. So I thank Tommy in leading that prayer. As we study this book, pray for our study, pray for our hearts and our minds to be open. Pray for me as I prepare the material, and I believe the discussion is not really the term I like, but I suppose just that's really the way it is. But as I, as we open our hearts and minds to God's Word, as you as students participate and contribute, that all of us together, as we each do what we're supposed to do, since we handle the Word of God so seriously, we might grow and we might benefit from our study. That being said, thank you for listening to those opening remarks. I hope that didn't just go in one ear and out the other. But I'm looking forward to our study. So we're going to start there in the book of Judges. And if you've read chapter 1, then it probably didn't take you long to realize this kind of book gives people a lot of problems. It's earthy. It's primitive. It's violent, as you gather from reading chapter 1. And if you answered those questions, you realize it's a really violent book. And because of the nature of those sort of things, we have a tendency to just gloss over the content of books like this. You're going to read things in here that probably caused you to do a double take. Did God just tell them to do that? That doesn't seem to fall in line with the character and the nature of God as we understand it, especially in the New Testament. And it's books like this where many people look at this and say, that's a different God. The God of the Old Testament, he's quite different. He's violent. He's vindictive. He's angry. And it's quite in contrast to the God we see when we read about him in the New Testament. However, my suggestion is that oftentimes it's our thinking that's out of sorts rather than God himself who is out of sorts. And the failure is not on God's part or the author's part, it's on our part as we fail to understand how this really helps us understand the character and the nature of God. So before we can get to the Judges, we're not actually going to be introduced to the first one until chapter 3. Until we can get to the Judges, we've got to go through chapters 1 and 2 to get to them. So let's just start with a question. This is going to be question 3, and like a dummy, I didn't label the questions, but I figure you can find the third question and follow along. So let's just start with this question. I'm going to read it, ask it, and then open it up for discussion. During the days of Moses, what did God command the children of Israel to do with the Canaanites? Okay, destroy them. To what degree?
Utterly.
Okay. A lot of people don't like the idea of that concept. The men of war, the women, the children, the animals, everything. Utterly wipe them out. Be turning to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 16 through 18. I'm going to ask Homer in just a moment to be reading that for us. Deuteronomy chapter 20. We'll look at verses 16 through 18. I'm ready.
But of the cities of these peoples which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall not let nothing that breathes remain alive. You shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. But you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, Amorite, Canaanite, Hezrite, Hivite and the Jebusite, just as the Lord your God has commanded you, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations which they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God.
Completely destroy the Canaanites. Now, there were people outside of the realm of Canaan that God told the Israelites they could make peace with. You can go, you can offer peace. If they settle for some alliance, good for them. They can be your slaves. However, there are certain nations I want you to absolutely demolish. To kill women, men, children, animals, all of them. It's commands like this that really cause people to stop and to say, that doesn't seem consistent with the God I know. The innocent children. Now, just stop for a moment. Let's all be honest. Has this command and things like this ever really bothered you? It's bothered me. As I've thought about the things that the children of Israel were commanded to do. I mean, okay, sure, the parents did all of these awful, terrible things, but what were the children guilty of that caused them to deserve the same punishment and the same fate that their parents believed. And oftentimes it's one of those things that we really skirt across and we put in the back of our mind because we can't really give a satisfactory answer. And so we'll pretend we didn't read it, or we'll just try our best to forget about it. We don't want to think about the things that God commanded Israel to do. However, it was God's command that several of these nations be completely wiped out. And so let me just put the question to you. How would you respond to someone who described God as violent? This is question, I think it's question four if you're following along on your questions. How would you respond to someone who described God as violent and evil based off of the Israelites' treatment of the Canaanites? So we're going to settle this right here. How would you describe it? What would you say in defense of God? Miss Johnny? Good answer. Good answer. Okay, that's how much God hates sin. And particularly, what about the sin of the people in Canaan? What was God doing? He was protecting his people, right? So, any other thoughts? Johnny?
I think if you look forward to part of the purpose, to God's purpose, I think, in my mind, God is trying to keep the Israelite nation pure as possible because he saw something in them that he didn't see in other nations, back all the way to Abraham, and that God's, the Messiah, is going to come from this nation. And in other words, I think the whole length of the Bible basically is designed for the Savior to come. You know, the whole idea of the Savior is going to come out of this nation. And the purer, the better it would be, even though they weren't a pure nation.
Okay, and this would be a purifying process by removing the idolatry from the land of the Canaan that was going to be given to the children of Israel. Good answer. Any other thoughts? Anybody else want to take a stab at this?
I got a question.
Okay. I hadn't thought about it in that context. I know what you're talking about, where Cain is cast from the land, and as a result of Cain, I'm going to wonder, probably not, considering Cain predated the flood. The flood was God's judgment on all of mankind. Now, I believe Cain was very influential in what was taking place during the days prior to the flood. And I think we see God's judgment on the world and its evil through the flood. But through that, Noah and his family preserved. And if you trace Noah's lineage back, I believe that would more so be pointed towards Seth and his genealogy, his family. So I don't know how much Cain would have to do with this. I would say that Cain and his descendants did, in a sense, bring about God's judgment, though, during the flood. Tommy?
Yeah, I don't believe it had to do with that, because the mark of Cain actually was put on him to protect him.
Okay.
The mark him where other people would not kill him.
Okay, but that is a good question, John, and that's something interesting in and of itself to discover, is the mark of Cain and the impact and purpose of that. Back to our question, anybody else want to? Dave? I think I know that one.
I'm not going to understand anything that God's got to do.
Okay.
And that's where my faith, what he's asking them to do, was necessary for whatever it is that he wanted to accomplish. So
okay.
You bring that forward to the New Testament and you say, okay, well, there's things there that I don't understand, but they're there for me. And so my faith comes in and I've got to be obedient to those.
Okay. And I know for a lot of us that's enough. And that's probably been the answer I would defer to through the years, is God's ways are above mine. Is that passage, that my ways are above your ways? We can't always understand the plans and the purposes of God. And a lot of times that would be how I simply dealt with this, because that's hard to understand. I don't understand it, but I do think there is somewhat of an answer. Let's read a few passages that we can give. And Dave, I'm with you right there on that. Our faith, we're to walk by faith and not by sight. And there are going to be times when we simply don't understand why it is that God commanded certain things. Well, let's look at a few passages, though. Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 4 through 6. John, would you read that whenever you get over there, please?
Speak not thou in thy heart after Jehovah thy God has trusted them out of before thee, saying, for my righteousness Jehovah has brought me into the promise of possessing of this land. Whereas for the wilderness of these nations, Jehovah has drive them out from before thee. not for thy righteousness, nor for the righteousness of the heart, that thou go into and possess this land, but for the wickedness of the nation, Jehovah thy God has drive them out from before thee, and that they may establish the word which Jehovah swore to his fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.
Okay, so God's speaking to Moses, and he says, this land that you're going to get, number one, it's not going to be given to you based off your own righteousness. You follow the children of Israel after they are out of Egyptian bondage, a very complaining and fearful and unfaithful people. God says, this land that you're going to get is based off a promise I gave to Abraham. And I think that's where the point Johnny made, where this is part of the big scheme that God has in mind. The lineage of the Messiah that's going to come. It's not because of your righteousness, Israel, that this land is being given to you. More to the point, it's because of their wickedness. In fact, you find out, and you try to rationalize all this. Go ahead and be turning to Genesis 15, but you try to rationalize this command, this to utterly destroy and to utterly punish man, woman, and child and bring about their death as the children of Israel were commanded to cleanse the land of Canaan. I'll be turning over to Genesis 15. A lot of people try to reconcile this with how is that just? Well, there was a previous time when Abraham was shown the land of Canaan as he stood and as he looked out at what God was going to one day give his people. And I think we'll be able to reconcile God's justice with a couple more passages. Ronnie, would you read Genesis 15, 12 through 16? You ever wondered why God didn't give Canaan to Abraham on the spot like he did with Isaac? You know, Abraham began to see saw the fulfillment of the promises God made, and he saw that through the birth of Isaac. However, he was never given the land. He was a sojourner and a pilgrim, as the Hebrew writer calls him, while he was here on this earth. Why didn't God give him a portion of Canaan as some sort of down payment as to what he was one day going to have, his people were one day going to have? It would have been unjust at that point in time for God to have taken what was someone else's and for no reason given it to Abraham. Did you notice the last portion of that verse in Genesis 15? He says, the iniquity of the Amalekites is not yet complete. There was going to be a lot that would transpire between when God made this promise to Abraham and said, you're one day going to get all of this. Your people are going to receive all of this as an inheritance. But I'm not giving it to you now. I'm not taking it away from them now. Now, God in his omniscience was able to look at them and say their iniquity, their wickedness was not so great to such a degree that he was going to act. He was not going to unjustly take what was theirs and give it to Abraham. But let's go, and as we see as time passes, the Egyptian bondage would occur. They'd find themselves there for several hundred years. And in the process of this time, let's look at how the morality and the practices of the Amorites and the Canaanites, and that term Amorite, it's sometimes used as a general term, sometimes as a specific term, speaking of the people that inhabited the land of Canaan, their behavior, their morals were going to grow worse and worse and worse. And in Deuteronomy 18, near the end of Moses' life, as the conquest is soon going to begin, look at what God says these people were practicing. Paul, would you read that for us? Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 through 14. And we're just kind of working our way back through passages, scripture readings.
When you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominable practices of those nations. They shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering, anyone who practices divination or tells fortunes or interprets omens or a sorcerer, or a charmer, or a medium, or a necromancer, or one who inquires of the dead. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you.
Okay.
You shall be blameless before the Lord your God for these nations which you are about to dispossess. Listen to fortune tellers and to the diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you to do this.
What were the Canaanites being charged with? What sins had they fallen into?
Witchcraft,
idolatry. One really stands out to me that God is simply detested, and sometimes his own people would fall into.
The sacrifice.
Okay. So previously when God looked at the Amorites and stood there with Abraham, they obviously had not fallen and degraded so far. Through this next process of time, some 400 years, their morality would degrade to such a degree as we see God describing here. Child sacrifice, witchcraft, sorcery, idolatry. Those are pretty terrible things, and they were all punishable under the old law by death. And so now all of a sudden what you see is not the children of Israel being given someone else's land simply. You see the children of Israel as God's instrument of justice and of judgment on these people. And as sad as it is, sometimes, even throughout the latter portion of the Bible, the children would have to atone for the sins of the parents. We see that frequently. We see that in David, his sin with Bathsheba. That was David's sin. That was Bathsheba's sin. But the punishment was the child that was conceived as a result of that adulterous relationship was the one that lost their life. David lost, but that child lost his life. And we see God here using the children of Israel to bring judgment on these people that had fallen into such terrible, awful practices that they were offering their young, passing them, sending them through the fire as they worshiped these false gods and listening to diviners and sorcerers and all of these things. What Israel did wasn't palatable. It wasn't pretty. It was violent and it was destructive, but it was God's judgment on the wickedness of those Canaanites that Israel was the tool for that. And so these Canaanites, they had no idea that some 4,000 years later, so many people would be bemoaning the fate of them and of their children. Those poor Canaanites, how they had their land ripped away from them and taken from them. Those poor Canaanites were sacrificing their children to idols and murdering one another and worshiping foreign gods and all of these terrible things. And it was Israel that was God's divine instrument in bringing about their punishment. You go back, God wasn't going to just take that away from them for no reason. The wickedness, the iniquity of the Amorites isn't complete. Not yet, Abraham. But there will come a day, and God in his omniscience would know how far these people would fall, and it would be the Israelites that would bring judgment to these people. Comments or questions on that passage, that question, any of that?
Well, you know, God is the same today as he was back then. When it comes to the final day of judgment, he's going to be just as terrible as he was back then.
You're right.
Hebrews tells us it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God.
These people fell into the hands of the living God, and yes, it cost them. It cost the men, the women, and it cost them their children. Think about it today in the context. You've got a father that's alcoholic, and he abuses his family. And yet the children suffer because of the sins of the father. It's not pretty, but it's just sometimes what happens. Sometimes, as sad as it is, those who were innocent suffer the most at the hands of the crimes of someone else. And we see that here in the book of Judges as well. Any other thoughts or questions? Good point, Tommy. All right. Let's look at question two. Kind of gone out of order on these. We've looked at questions four and questions three. I hope that satisfies everyone. It's hard to sometimes swallow when you look at what Israel was commanded to do, but you have to look at it in the terms of, as Dave says, God's ways, God's thinking. And it wasn't just cold-blooded murder. It was judgment that was being brought on these wicked people for their sins against God. All right, what is the key passage to you in this chapter? And I'm going to go ahead and say mine so nobody else can steal it. And I put the answer in there, and I didn't realize I made a note for myself, and I meant to take it out, and I didn't. So I'm going to say the key passage to me is Judges 1:28, where it says, "It came about when Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely." And I think that's really going to set the tone for the rest of the book and what we're going to see. However, did any other passages stand out that anyone would like to share that they might say, well, this to me is a key verse? Miss Johnny?
Verse 19.
Okay. That's going to be a question we'll have later. Was it faith or failure on behalf of the Israelites while they were unable to drive them out? You're thinking ahead. Dave?
I picked verse 3.
Verse 3?
And instead of just going to it and getting it done, they went asked Simeon, or Simeon to come up and help them.
Okay.
Instead of having the faith that they would have, what that was necessary, I think it set a tone for the rest of them.
Okay.
Here you are, Judas the biggest there is out of all of them. And so instead of just going up and doing what they should have done and then setting the example for the rest of them, they picked the smallest of the tribe.
Okay. That's it. That is interesting, and I appreciate you bringing that up. I kind of looked at it from a different perspective, and as we proceed a little bit in the first few verses here in a moment, I kind of got a different idea about the going up together kind of deal. But that's an interesting thought on that particular passage. So we'll look at that a little bit more as we proceed on. Good point. Anyone else want to share any other observations, passages that stood out to them? All right, let's delve into the text then. With 5 minutes remaining, we'll see how much of the first 8 verses we can cover. Judges chapter 1, let's tell you what, verses 1 through 7. Brother Campbell, would you read that for us, please? Yes, sir. Verse 7.
And they found Adonibezek in Berserk, and they fought against him, and they slew the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And that same guy fled, and they pursued after him and caught him and cut off his thumb and his great toe. And then he said, 70 kings having their thumb and their great toe cut off, gathered their meat under my table. As I have done, so God hath requited me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died.
Okay, we're going to encounter that in the book of Judges. So thank you, Tommy, for reading it. Just do your best. Pronouns are your friend if you don't want to try to pronounce. Here, there, he, she, they. Have a field day when you're reading. If you don't want to try to pronounce the names, we're all reading it together, so we understand what it says. If you don't want to try to butcher the names like I'm sure I do when I attempt to read, just substitute with your favorite pronoun. So thank you for reading that, Tommy. It starts out with a book of beginnings. The book of Judges is a book of new beginnings. It seems like oftentimes new beginnings are often punctuated by the death of God's servants. You think about the book of Exodus. It begins with the death of Joseph. You look at the book of Joshua. It begins with the death of Moses. You think about Judges, we just read verse 1. It begins with the death of Joshua. You think about 1 Kings. It begins with the death of David. Now, all of these men are very admired by a Jewish society, and no wonder why. They were men of faith. They were leaders. They were people who stood for God when others wouldn't stand for God. And you oftentimes wonder, what's going to happen whenever such and such leader dies? They pass on. They depart. The children of Israel were no doubt fearful whenever Moses died and the next person was going to have to step up to lead Israel. No doubt whenever David died, they wondered, okay, who's going to step up and lead God's people? And whenever a leader dies, and you can even bring it down to the level of a local congregation and make application for us. Our elders, our shepherds, our leaders, when it gets to that point in time in which they're no longer able to lead, we may have a tendency to be fearful. We may have a tendency to worry. What's going to happen to the church when those who've guarded and shepherded it and protected it for years, when they're no longer able to do so? What we see as we read through here is even when Sheol takes the greatest servants that God has, and these are some of the greatest servants that arose in the history of the children of Israel, God's kingdom's not going to collapse. You know, there may be down times and there may be bad times, and we're going to see that as we read through the book of Judges. But even whenever God's greatest servants are taken, we need to remember that men are still men. And men are great because of God, not because of their own innate ability, because of God and what He has empowered them to do. And they listen to His wisdom, and they look to Him for strength and for guidance. And men, however great they may be, they're still just at the end of the day men. And you read through this book, you look at verse 2, what you find out? Verse 2, the Lord said, Judah shall go up, behold, I have given the land into his hand. Verse 4, Judah went up, the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand. Verse 19, the Lord was with Judah. Joshua was gone. They didn't have the same sort of leadership, and I believe that's part of the problem of the book of Judges, is that they didn't have the same leadership. But who was with them each time? Well, it was God that was with them. It was God that was with Joseph and Moses and Joshua and David that made them great. It's with God, and through His wisdom and power, that guides and the elders of our congregation and other congregations, and so that whenever they're no longer able to do their work, God will work through others. So that even when death may take the most faithful and the greatest leaders, God's people don't have to fear. We're part of an eternal kingdom, and I think sometimes we need to remember that. And we're going to pick up our study next week with what the comment that Dave made on verse 3. We're going to see a little bit of corporate unity amongst the tribes here. And we can talk next week whether that was a good thing or whether that was a bad thing, or whether it really didn't matter at all. So I appreciate everyone's attention. Anyone have any comments or questions they'd like to have before we bring this particular class to a close? Okay, and this, my similar style, I guess, we didn't cover but about two or three verses. We're going to make more progress in that next week. So hopefully we won't spend more than two or three weeks here, but we'll pick up next week looking at the first portion of the chapter, specifically verse 3, where we see Judah and Simeon teaming up to take on the Canaanites. So think about that. Read through the chapter again next week. Pray about our class. Give thought to the questions. I thank everyone for their participation in our study this morning.